more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. A few moments ago, historian John Goerda talked about the immediate past that contributed to the seemingly unprecedented political year that was. But we wanted to look further into the forces that were at work even as Scott Walker was elected to the governor's seat. Milwaukee-area attorney and conservative blogger Rick Essenberg has been tracking the course of conservative-leaning politics here for years. And he tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce this has been a unique period of time in Wisconsin politics for the left and the right.
I would like to claim that I predicted it. I wrote an article for WI Interest Magazine at the beginning of the year, and which I said that, look, those of us in Milwaukee have come to know Scott Walker. And whether you like him or you don't like him, he's one of those politicians who gets elected in order to do something. And we know that in Milwaukee, and people in Wisconsin are going to find that out. But I don't think that I ever imagined that we would have the kind of sort of tumult and all politics all the time that we've had since February.
Can we trace what's happened this past year with Governor Walker's policy changes to his term here as county executive or even before he was elected in that position? I mean, what wheels were set in motion that resulted in what we've seen here?
Well, I think that Scott Walker, and you know, you could name people on, you know, on the left who are sort of equally committed, is the type of politician who wants to accomplish something and who has found that sticking to his guns works for him. So he was a guy who managed to get elected in Milwaukee County, which is a heavily Democratic county. I mean, and here he is, a Republican, elected to county executive. Now, to be sure, that was because there was this pension scandal. It was an unusual set of circumstances. But then he managed to get reelected several times and did so by pretty much sticking to his guns, right? He said he wasn't going to raise taxes, and he generally submitted a budget that called for no tax increases. Now, it's true that, you know, the county board overrode his budget a couple of times and they had minor tax increases, but he basically did what he said he was going to do. And as a result of doing what he said he was going to do, he kept getting reelected. And, you know, politicians learn. And when things work for them, they continue to do them. And so I think it was absolutely predictable that he would come into the state house and sort of continue to do what he had done in the past. That is to govern as a small government, low tax conservative, and that he would do it in a bold way without a great deal of regard for the need to compromise or appeal to those who didn't, you know, share his perspectives on public policy. And so, you know, in a word, he was going to act bold. And whether you like it or not, I think we can all agree that it was bold.
Well, let's talk about what he walked into when he was elected governor. What was the state's fiscal situation, and did it really justify this budget repair bill that was so controversial?
Well, it was a mess, and everybody knew it was a mess. You know, we have a $3.6 billion structural deficit. It was built over time. The state is a little bit different than the federal government. It cannot run a budget deficit. Our state constitution requires that current revenues match current expenditures. And what prior governors had done, and not just, you know, Jim Doyle, but Republican predecessors before him, is they had tended to use sort of accounting tricks and one-off fixes in order to sort of close that gap so that the budget would pass legal muster for any particular biennium. But here we had about a $3.6 billion budget deficit. And I remember talking to this, you know, reading about it and talking to a number of people about it before the election, that, you know, we were sort of amazed that either Tom Barrett or Scott Walker would want to be governor because they were going to have to deal with this, that the tricks and the one-offs had sort of run out. And so one thought that we would either be looking at very significant tax increases or very substantial reduction in services with, you know, the consequent political impacts. And so it's not surprising that there came to be a crisis that needed to be dealt with. It needed to be dealt with. I think what we didn't see is the way that Governor Walker would choose to deal with it.
In taking bold action to address this structural deficit, did he see an opportunity to go further? I mean, he as much as admitted that the collective bargaining aspects of the law weren't necessarily going to save the state much money.
Oh, I disagree that they weren't going to save the state money. And I think this is what he did. You know, normally we argue around the margin in politics. You know, Democrats want to spend a little more, tax a little more. Republicans want to spend a little less, tax a little less. And what Walker did was he said, look, I'm not going to raise taxes, but I'm not simply going to let that translate itself into massive service cuts either. I'm going to try to see if we can deliver the same services or close to the same services at a lower cost. And unions are a cartel. I mean, there's no way around that. That's the economic theory behind unions. That's what they're supposed to do. They are sort of a concerted action on the part of employees, which is designed to, in economic terms, sort of raise the – modify the demand, the supply curve for labor. And the result of that is you wind up with higher wages, probably somewhat lower employment, and maybe some combination of higher prices and lower profits in the private sector. In the public sector, the only thing that can happen is that you result in a higher cost to government and perhaps fewer government employees. That's what public employee unionization inevitably leads to, that simple economic theory. Now, you may decide that that's a good thing, that that's more fair for public employees, but that is nevertheless the fact. And it's complicated in the public sector because public employee unions, unlike private unions, have a great deal to do with who runs the government. You know, private unions normally don't influence the selection of management. Public employee unions have a great deal of impact on the selection of the politicians with whom they are going to bargain. And what Walker said was, okay, look, if we use a different model of labor relations, if we go back to the model of public employee relations that we had in the 1950s and for many public employees into the 70s here in the state of Wisconsin, and that we have today in about half the states, that we might be able to provide public services more efficiently, that we might be able to weather this inevitable reduction in government spending because we have to close the structural deficit and he wasn't going to raise taxes without having a commensurate reduction in services. And what we see is that he was right. Now, there are people that don't like it, but the fact of the matter is that he wound up closing a $3.6 billion structural deficit without raising taxes and without $3.6 billion worth of service cuts.
But let me ask, why wasn't it enough if the public unions were willing to pay more for their health care and contribute more to their pensions? Why did he need to go after collective bargaining?
Because that's not all that's involved. That's not the only way in which collective bargaining raises the cost of providing services. There are, you know, unionized workplaces tend to have a variety of work rules which limit the flexibility of managers. They tend to make it more difficult to get rid of people who are not performing adequately. And there was a big issue here with respect to the ability of unions to negotiate that their health care be provided by WEA Trust, which tends to be more expensive than other health care providers. So it's not simply a question of pensions and health care benefits. There are other issues that impact costs that are involved as well.
Now, you said before that public unions have a unique position in that they can heavily influence their so-called manager, who they end up bargaining with. And given that many public unions are, in fact, Democratic-leaning, could we look at Governor Walker's stripping of the collective bargaining rights of public unions as an attack on a constituency that doesn't support him and his party?
these reforms clearly had political implications, but they had political implications on both sides. If we look at where this has happened in other states, Mitch Daniels issued an executive order in Indiana that basically said that, you know, state employees didn't have to pay union dues if they didn't want to pay them. 5% decided to pay them. Now, that is an existential threat to public employee unions and correspondingly a close to existential threat to the Democratic Party. So clearly there's that political aspect of it. But if you're going to talk about the political aspect of it, then you have to talk about both sides, that the Democrats also had a particularly sweet deal that they didn't want to get they didn't want to lose, where you basically had, you know, public employees who were compelled to pay union dues, some of which would wind up in the coffers of the Democratic Party. And the, you know, while you can choose not to join the union and have a fair share agreement, there are always issues about, you know, whether you're really being charged for stuff that just relates to bargaining or whether it's political stuff. So yeah, there were political ramifications, but there were political ramifications on both sides. You can't say it's just the Republicans are being political or just the Democrats are being political. They both had a political interest in the outcome of this.
Were there broader political or ideological agendas taking shape that the events that unfolded here in Wisconsin became part of? And I mean, what role will Wisconsin play in future national campaigns, particularly looking in 2012?
You know, sure there was, because Wisconsin sort of became, I like to use the term, the bloody Kansas of our political civil wars, where, you know, that our disagreements with respect to the relative size of government and the proper amount of taxation all came to be played out on our little battlefield. And so people looked at what was happening in Wisconsin and, you know, national conservatives looked and said, oh, my gosh, there's a governor who's doing something that we really, really like. We better support him. And Democratic interests and organized labor interests looked at Governor Walker and they said, oh, my gosh, there's a governor doing something that we really, really hate. We better make sure that he doesn't get away with it. And so we became kind of this template for fighting this battle. And it doesn't show any sign of stopping. You know, we had the battle over the legislation. Then we had, you know, the Supreme Court election that got sort of, you know, turned into a proxy contest on Walker. Then we had the first round of recalls. Now we're having the second round of recalls. And, you know, for people like me that really like this stuff, you know, who are weird enough that we get up in the morning and we read about it and we write about it, oh, it's great fun. For people who are political consultants, and I'm not, I don't earn a penny on any of this, it's a boon. It's a windfall. And but one of the things that has struck me and I think is very unfortunate is that, you know, this is a disagreement which operates within a relatively small band. I mean, are we going to require people to pay another 5.8% of their income towards their pension or health care or not? Are we going to have a collective bargaining regime that looks more like the regime in about half of the other states, because about half of the states don't permit public bargaining? Are we going to close this gap more by raising taxes or more by spending? And, you know, these are important issues and they're issues on which reasonable people can disagree. But I would have hoped that we would have been able to discuss them more civilly without taking the position that the people who disagree with us are unintelligent, corrupt, or immoral. Because, I tend to find it, and I make no bones about it, I'm a conservative. But some of it sounds trite, but some of my best friends are liberals. And you know what? They're not immoral, corrupt, or unintelligent. They just see things a little differently than I do. And I would hope that through all of this, we would have been able to be more civil to one another than we have been. But unfortunately, that's not been the case.
Well, Rick Essenberg, thank you so much for coming in and being part of this.
Thanks for having me.
Milwaukee attorney Rick Essenberg is the president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. He's also an adjunct professor of law at Marquette University Law School. His legal writings have been published in the Harvard Law Review, the William & Mary Bill of Rights Journal, the Mississippi Law Journal, and others. He blogs at Shark and Shepherd, and you can find a link from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. That is the Monday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, more of Project Milwaukee, State of Upheaval. We will talk about the winners and losers over the past year and the complex nature of figuring out who's a winner and who's a loser. Don't forget, we'll have a special live Lake Effect broadcast on Friday morning. You can find out more about that and our whole Project Milwaukee series by going to wuwm.com/Project Milwaukee. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM FM and HD1, Milwaukee Public Radio. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.